we are going to be presented a video of Professor Lawrence Lessig on how we, the people, speak better and can be better heard. Unfortunately, Professor Lessig's schedule was disrupted, and he was able to provide us his presentation on video. And he will be, though, checking in later on audio to participate in the panel. Professor Lessig is a law professor, activist, scholar, and an author. Lawrence Lessig is a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. Previously, he founded the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School and previously taught at the University of Chicago. A founding board member of Creative Commons, Lessig serves on the scientific board of the AXA Research Fund. And his awards include a Webby, Free Software Foundation's Freedom Award, Scientific American 50, and Fast Case 50 Awards. Cited by the New Yorker as, quote, the most important thinker on intellectual property in the internet age, Lessig's current work addresses institutional corruption, relationships which, while legal, weaken public trust in an institution, especially as that affects democracy. His books include They Don't Represent Us, Fidelity and Constraint, How the Supreme Court Has Read the American Constitution, America Compromised, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress, and A Plan to Stop It, among other books.
In 2018, Yorgos Lanthimos gave us this extraordinary film, The Favorite. Here's a brief clip.
Dearest Queen, you are mad, giving me a palace. It is a monstrous extravagance. Mrs. Morley, we are at war.
We won.
Oh, it is not over. We must continue.
Oh. Oh, I did not know that.
The Queen is an extraordinary person.
They were all staring, weren't they? I can tell even if I can't see, and I heard the word fat, and ugly.
No one but me would dare, and I did not.
She's been stalked by tragedy.
Everyone leaves me. He dies.
So this film evinces a certain style. The style is to render the monarchy absurd, embarrassing, but hidden. That fact, hidden from the general public, until it is not. And when it is not, we know from the history of monarchy, monarchies are destroyed. Now, the point I want to make in this short talk I have with you today is that the same is true with democracy. If the demos, us, if we were to become absurd, or at least seem absurd, ignorant, irrational, self-destructive, when that, or let's say if that happens, then democracy will be destroyed too. And it's an uncomfortable truth that we're getting very close to that place right now. Because we ourselves are losing faith in us, in our own judgments about what should happen in democratic politics. Pew has been studying this question for the last 20-some years. In 1997, finding more than two-thirds of Americans had confidence in the public's political wisdom. But in the 20 years since, that confidence has collapsed. Now more than two-thirds don't have confidence in the public's opinions. So the questions I want to address in this talk are, number one, why is that so? And number two, how can we fix it? Okay, why is it so? We need to recognize that we live in a time when understanding doesn't pay. We've evolved an economy of media. We're producing understanding in us about important issues of public policy, that understanding doesn't pay. Let's focus the point a bit by thinking about the history of impeachment. When the 17th president of the United States, Andrew Johnson, became the first president to be impeached, this was a picture of journalism then. That journalism, that media, created a certain kind of public. That public was fragmented and partisan. Or at least we suspect. We can't actually know because they couldn't know what their public was because that public's views were invisible. There's a picture of invisible. And that's invisible because polling did not yet exist. James Bryce, who wrote The American Commonwealth at the end of the 19th century, famously said that a final stage in the evolution of democracy would be reached, quote, if the will of the majority of citizens were to become ascertainable at all times. But we were not yet at that place because the public was still illegible. And so if you said, what do the people think? That would have been a laughable question because there was no way to know what the people thought. So the point is, when Johnson was impeached, he was impeached in a context where the public was fragmented and illegible, which suggests we could imagine a public that was not fragmented but concentrated and a public that was legible. Okay, so the 19th century evolved to the 20th century and technology changed. Or I want to say technologies changed. In particular, two technologies changed. Let's think of them as thing one and thing two. Thing one that changed was broadcasting. The emergence of a technology where many could hear at one time the very same thing. Now, all broadcasting is important in the history of the story, but the most important broadcasting is television. Because as Marcus Pryor from Princeton describes, television changed everything for American politics, not just because of the concentration in the media itself. In 1977, 90% still reported getting their news from three major networks, but more importantly, because of the addiction of the technology. Television was irresistible. People would flip it on and leave it on all the time. And because it was video, it was understandable and therefore egalitarian. Everybody in the household could understand what was being said. And so as more citizens saw what was on television about politics, more became engaged in politics. And they became engaged in mainstream and trusted sources of information. Everybody experienced this daily lesson from the likes of Walter Cronkite, building a common understanding, we could say a thick common understanding. And on the basis of that common knowledge, there was increased political engagement, as Marcus Pryor has demonstrated, and progress. Okay, that's thing one, how we know. And broadcasting affected that dramatically, which is why Marcus Pryor calls it the age of broadcast democracy. Okay, thing two asks about how we are read. How legible are we? Because the thing we're likely to miss in the history of broadcasting is an extraordinary coincidence, that broadcasting takes off just as polling is born. 1936, this man, George Gallup, astonished the world by proving that polling, by just asking a random selection of about 1,000 people, could better predict a political result than massive straw polls where millions had submitted their ballots. Gallup gave us a glimpse of this final stage in the evolution of democracy, where the majority would be ascertainable at all times. Gallup showed us the final stage was within our technological grasp. Now, the key here is to recognize that when polling was born, it was born to a very special public. There was a happy coincidence that we learned how to read the people just when the people had something smart to say. And they had something smart to say because they knew a common set of facts. And based on that knowledge, we progressed. Okay, now both technologies are important for bringing us together after the technologies of the 19th century and before had broken us apart, both Thing One and Thing Two were important, and they were especially important to the fate of the almost second president to be impeached, Richard Nixon. Because as the story of Watergate was told, America listened, because it couldn't help but listen. It couldn't help because every station covered the story and everyone watched what was on television. And as they listened, America learned. And as they learned, they were read, they were polled. We were the legible public. These polls capture Americans' attitudes towards Richard Nixon. The top line, the red line, is Republican support, approval for the president, which in the beginning period is just like the Republican support for Donald Trump, hovering around the 80s. The middle line is independent. The bottom line is Democratic support, which of course is much less substantial. These are all stable until the story of Watergate begins to be told. And as the story is told, there's a dramatic consequence across the political spectrum at almost precisely the same rate. Approval of Richard Nixon collapses until finally it falls below 50%. Even for Republicans. We were one nation, we heard one story, and there was one consequence of that story. The crook had to resign. Okay, so the point is, in the second almost impeachment, the media was concentrated, just few sources that drove the story of Richard Nixon and his crimes, and the public was legible. So that as we saw what the public believed, that reinforced the conclusion that Nixon had to go. Okay, so the 20th century, of course, has evolved now to the 21st century, and technology, of course, has changed again and changed dramatically. Think first about television. This graph captures the evolution of television, the technology of television. These dark bars represent the penetration of the big three networks, which start in 1985 at about 70%, and by 2002 have fallen to around 30% concentration. The second bar is the cable penetration, which in 1985 is around 43%, and by 2002, 83% of people have access to cable. And then the line represents the number of channels on these cable systems, from the beginning at around 13 to, by the end, around 115 channels. And the consequence of these three together is obviously that many people have an extraordinary range of things to watch. They're not all forced into the content of just three networks. And of course, cable is only the beginning. On top of the cable lines, we wired a new network, the internet, which of course exploded the range of contents, giving us many, many more sources, leading to an extraordinary fragmentation again, as we all consume what we want to consume and we all don't want to consume the same thing. Now, this change has a dramatic effect on what people watch. Those who were forced before to watch the news, because only the news was on, are not forced now, and they don't watch now. And those who do watch now, the so-called news junkies, are also partisan junkies. And that changes, then, the business model of broadcasters. No longer are broadcasters like Walter Cronkite possible. Instead, broadcasters like Sean Hannity prevail. Because in this world, partisan pays. And more partisan pays more. Here's an extraordinary, terrifying graph that captures this transformation. This measures the ideological content of the three major cable networks, CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC. And what this shows is that at the beginning here, in the 2000s, the overlap in the ideological content of these three networks is perfect. There is no difference between these three networks in the content, the ideological content of what they present. But as the decades continue, for the last 20 years, we've seen a radical shift in the content that these networks present, each focusing on what the base wants to hear and feeding the base precisely what that base wants to know. And the internet, of course, just makes this even worse. Tristan Harris, an employee at Google, former employee at Google, who left to start the Center for Humane Technology. Tristan has been building our understanding of the science of attention, the way that these technology companies engineer attention to overcome our resistance to these technologies. You can think of it as a kind of brain hacking. And we can understand that by comparing it to an equivalent, body hacking. Michael Moss, in his book Salt, Sugar, Fat, tells the extraordinary story of food science, which is a kind of science where scientists learn to engineer food to overcome our natural resistance. By food, I mean food like this, exploiting evolution with the aim to sell food, or quote-unquote food. And of course, they get quite good at making that, quote, food addictive. Brain hacking is the very same thing in the context of the mind. Exploiting evolution, the fact that we've been evolved to be especially responsive to random rewards, or can't begin to resist bottomless pits of content, to exploit those evolved characteristics of us with the aim to sell ads. Because that's now the business model, to sell ads. And that business model creates incentives. The incentives is the incentive to know more about us, not just by watching us, but by poking us, tweaking us, asking us questions, rendering us vulnerable, reaching down, as Tristan Harris puts it, the brain stack to leverage insecurity so that we reveal more, so that we show more for the purpose of selling ads better. Zeynep Tufekci describes, quote, "The companies are in the business of monetizing attention, and not necessarily in ways that are conducive to health or success of social movements or the public sphere." Okay, and then it turns out, extremely unfortunately for us, that the best strategy to sell ads, to trigger engagement, to get us involved in the context of politics, is to play the politics of hate, to drive us to be as polarized and ignorant as we can so that we engage more, that so that they can sell more ads. Now, the point is, together, cable and the internet means that we have produced an increasingly fragmented public and an increasingly partisan public. Now, those two ideas, fragmented and partisan, might lead you to say, well, wait, so are we just now returning to the 19th century? And the answer to that question is no. Because remember, they were not legible, but we are. We are a legible public. And so what we are read to say means we've become a normative public, a not-to-be-ignored public, but not just one public, but many publics. Barack Obama described, quote, "If you watch Fox News, you're in one reality. And if you read the New York Times, you're in a different reality." So you can imagine the politician saying, hey, this is what my people say. And so whatever it is that they say, what am I supposed to do except do what my people believe? Now, these technologies, these evolving technologies, are critically important then to the fate of the third impeached president. It's actually this president who was the second, but the third and fourth impeached president, Donald Trump. Because think about how these different realities produce different stories in the public about that impeachment with different effect. We don't see a graph like this for Donald Trump's time in office. Instead, the graph is like this. Even the graph all the way to the end of his term is like this. Both lines, essentially unaffected by anything that happens. Constant support among Republicans, constant opposition among Democrats, regardless of what we learned or what the facts were. These two publics living in our own tribal bubbles, increasingly understanding little else from the other side, easily led to moments of craziness. Okay, so this fills out the matrix here. As we think about a president impeached against the background of a fragmented but legible public. And what this means is that impeachment in each of these moments is a radically different affair. In the first moments, when Johnson was impeached, he was impeached by an elite-driven process because the public was invisible. In the second moment, in the Nixon moment of impeachment, it's a people-driven process because we have a common view that drives the politicians in response to our common view. But in the moment we're in right now, it's tribally driven, and each drives to an opposite end because each has been led to believe an opposite reality, because leading us to believe opposite realities is a good way to keep us engaged. Okay, now the point to recognize is that we have never been here before except once in the Civil War, when our radically polarized views were visible to everyone because we waged a war because of them. We have rarely, except for that one point, been in a moment where we were so fragmented, so polarized, and yet so legible. And so legibility means normatively significant. Our tribal and visible views become authoritative in our democracy. And the question we need to ask is, how do we do democracy here? How do we make common judgments about what we should do, given the facts as they are, when each of us is in a different reality? Okay, let me summarize where we are so far, because it's an important point to have clear. We've evolved a business model for media that does not favor common understanding. It works against common understanding. It works against common understanding because common understanding doesn't pay them. And so they are focused on producing a public that maximizes the return to them, even if it destroys the capacity for democratic politics to happen effectively. Okay, that's the why. Let's think about the more important question of how do we fix it? We all know there's no simple solution to this problem, but one approach to the problem of unhealthy eating caused by the body hacking of the processed food industry is the movement called the slow food movement. And what the slow food movement says is, look, let's step back and understand how the human body works, and then fit the practice of eating to the human body as we know it. And what that tells us is that we should eat given how our bodies work. And so, in essence, the lesson from that is that we should be all cooking, because you can't make the poison that you buy from processed food companies inside your own kitchen. You're just not that good. And then once you've cooked, eat your food with your friends, which will inevitably mean you will eat your food slowly. That's the slow food movement. Now, likewise, there's no simple solution to the partisan polarization that we've seen in American democracy right now. But one approach that mitigates the problem we could call the slow democracy movement. And this too begins by saying, let's understand how the human mind works, and let's do democracy given how our minds work. So from this perspective, Twitter and Facebook are the equivalents of fast food, not good for us, even if they are very addictive. And so in response to recognizing that they're not good for us, the slow democracy movement says we need to change where we do politics. And we should do politics only in places that work, where we as humans can do it well, where we as humans can process the information, the complexity, the difficult choices that democracy demands well. So, for example, in the context of long-form journalism, like podcasts, where you can listen over time to complexities in the story and internalize that understanding through a process that is very human. Or narrative. Think about the extraordinary show, The Morning Show, which tells an incredible story about the complexity of the Me Too movement and the issues that make that so difficult for society to grapple with. And we could say, finally, to face-to-face discussions, where we know if structured properly in the context of deliberations in groups, we as humans can do the complexity of politics well. This has led many of us to start a new group, which we call deliberations.us, which aims to take complicated issues and make those issues understandable through short, professionally crafted videos. And then gather diverse souls together to deliberate about those issues. The first topic we began with was the Electoral College. Here's a short video to explain the process.
You've got an important perspective.
What you think matters.
And we want to hear about it.
For the first time in American history, we're bringing thousands of people together, virtually, to discuss a fundamental question. How should we elect the president?
Every election cycle, there's a little understood system that suddenly takes center stage. You may have heard about it. It's the Electoral College.
It inspires some heated debate.
But mostly, just lots of questions.
How does the Electoral College work?
How does a candidate win?
Is this the best way to elect a president?
Is this the only way to elect a president?
It's an issue that divides us, but it doesn't have to be.
So we're bringing together a whole bunch of people, just like you, in small, diverse groups to really talk about the Electoral College.
Talk about how it works.
Talk about how it could work.
And think through all the pros and cons for yourselves.
From every walk of life, Americans are coming together to share their opinions and experiences in thoughtful conversation.
In these discussions on our specially designed platform, you'll show us what Americans are really thinking. But don't worry, you don't have to be an expert.
The results of this historic project will be national news and could influence elections to come.
So what do you think? Want to be a part of this conversation?
And make your voice heard?
So the point is, we build on something the pandemic has taught us how to do, engaging in small group discussions virtually, and then build from those small groups, no more than 8 to 10 people talking together, many small groups, because the platform that we are deploying on could have tens of thousands of small groups deliberating at the same time. We could imagine 1 million people deliberating at the same time. And then with each of these deliberations, for each of the topics we will eventually cover, we start by surveying the group that is going to deliberate, to see their attitudes as they begin. And then they all watch these instructional videos that teach them about the issue in a way that everyone can understand. And then they begin the process of deliberation for at least an hour to work through the issues that the videos have covered. And then we survey them again to see how their attitudes have evolved because of the deliberation. The results we've seen with the Electoral College are really extraordinary, demonstrating we can build cross-partisan understanding and even agreement about this issue that has become so divisive in American politics today. So take, for example, the question of whether we should have a national popular vote, an issue which, of course, everybody has been thinking about for many years, at least since the election of 2000. And on that issue, we see a very pronounced partisan division, with Democrats overwhelmingly supporting the idea of a national popular vote and Republicans not. And unsurprisingly, because this is an issue people have been hearing and thinking and talking about for many, many years, deliberation doesn't change those numbers substantially. Slightly more Republicans support national popular vote than afterwards, but still it remains a partisan issue across the public generally. But then a second kind of reform is something people are not so familiar with, the idea of making it so that the electoral vote gets allocated proportionally in each state. So that if you get 35% of the vote in Montana as a Democrat, you would get exactly 35% of the electoral votes in Montana. The most important consequence of that change would mean that presidents would have a reason to be campaigning everywhere because every single vote could matter to whether they ultimately prevailed in the presidential election. Now, before deliberation, attitudes about this were slightly polarized. People didn't really understand it much, but Republicans favored it less than Democrats, who favored it less than independents. But after deliberation, there was a substantial change in support for this change across all groups, radically reducing the polarized perspective on this question, because as people understood it, they understood how to make democracy better for America, not for any political party. And then finally, we polled on the question of ranked choice voting, where people have the choice to rank their preferences rather than just saying the one person they would vote for. Democrats support this more generally than Republicans do. But after deliberation, we saw a substantial increase in support in all three groups. Okay, so the point is not so much about the Electoral College. The point is to imagine taking this strategy and making it so ultimately we can multiply the issues and the context in which people can deliberate. And when we have hundreds of contexts where literally millions of people have been deliberating, we can show again and again that the consequence of that deliberation is not that we are ridiculous or that the United States is ridiculous, that the people themselves are not capable of governing, but that we can be sensible. That if we engage in the right place, in the right context, we can produce results that we, the people, would have confidence in because they are, on reflection, sensible results that make sense for our nation. Now, of course, this is just an experiment, just the beginning. We haven't yet deployed this anywhere broadly. But we need urgently to begin these experiments to build out this idea of a slow democracy. Because if we don't find a way to make us believe that we have a role in governing ourselves that we can respect and be proud of, we will weaken the commitment to democracy, and we will strengthen the support for its alternatives, whether that's government led by experts or the autocracies that we see growing across the world today. Okay, one final word, summarizing a point I've tried to make again and again. Let's go back to the beginning. If you live in a world where understanding doesn't pay, what do you do? Because we live in a world right now where the infrastructure of media is an infrastructure of manipulation. The infrastructure is manipulating us to get us to engage so that they make more money. This is great for them because of the money they make, which is among the highest of any industry right now. But it's not so good for us, because democracy requires understanding. And if we don't have understanding, we will not have a democracy. Thanks very much.